Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting edition of Modern Day Philosophers. I am your host, Danny Lobel. You are the listeners out there living in this world, tuning into this podcast, and hopefully enjoying life. I'm doing my best to do so as well. I've been pretty happy. I just got back from Minnesota from doing my weekend at the Joke Joint Comedy Club there. That was such a blast. I love traveling. I love doing stand-up. I love seeing the world. It's just really cool. And I love having you guys. I love the listeners. I had some listeners of this show show up to my shows in St. Paul. And it was like so exciting. It's like we're both in on the same secret world, you know? It's like, you listen to that thing I do? It's like, you know, I've said it once before, but I feel like you guys are like the original Braveheart members, you know? The guys who teamed up with William Wallace before, like, it became a huge army. I always wanted to be William Wallace, except for, like, the ending, you know. But it was a blast. One listener showed up with his girlfriend, and we hung out with another comic and the club owner. And after the show, we just drank the night away, hanging out on the back porch of the club, which was super awesome. It was late, you know, late. Obviously, it's late at night. It was nighttime. Bats were flying over our heads. There were these really cool trees hanging over the porch. And you could hear frogs making frog noises on the Mississippi River. I was like, oh, this is so damn cool. And we just laughed and enjoyed that night and enjoyed hanging out. It was a special moment for me. And then Thursday night, I had a listener. I'm going to give him a shout out. Craig Vandershagen. He showed up to my show and he said, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, nothing. Because, by the way, there's nothing to do when you're alone in another city. That's the only... there's not nothing to do, but it can be lonely, and that's the only downside to being on the road. Steve Martin talked about it a little bit in his book, if you wanted to get an idea, I mean, on the highest level of what it's like, but it's true. It's you want someone to hang out with. That's the ideal. If I was some rich comedian, I'd just bring friends along on the road, and we could hang out and check out these different cities together. So it was really cool. He said, yeah, I'll come by tomorrow if you want and show you some of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And he did. And really cool dude. We hung out. We went to an art museum. We got lunch. We went to a record shop. We got some awesome vinyls. I picked up some great jazz I brought home with me. Then I got to see his photo studio, which is so damn cool that I got to give it a plug. You can go check out his work. It's at craigvanders.com. What an awesome dude. And a great modern-day philosopher listener. Wouldn't that be great? Profile. And now to profile another great modern-day philosopher's listener, Craig Vandershagen, photographer in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Well, anyway, thanks, Craig. Thanks for a great day. I appreciate that. Today's episode is brought to you by two very wonderful people, two very close to my heart people, the first of which has been a guest on this show. One of my favorite guests, in fact, Mr. Dylan Brody, who I share a kinship with in that we both love telling stories. He's a wonderful, phenomenal storyteller. If you haven't heard his episode, go listen to it right now. Right now. Well, maybe after this episode. Or now. You can pause it. I'm not going to tell you how to live your life. Anyway, Dylan has a book called Laughs Last, which is available for purchase on Amazon and Barnes & Noble online as well. And I really want to stress, please don't just hear the ad. Go and do these things. Go and get Dylan's book. It's a phenomenal book. I'm personally in the middle of reading it. I love it. I'm not going to ruin it for you, but Dylan's just a beautiful writer and a beautiful storyteller, and it's not even expensive. It's very affordable. Go get a book from Dylan Brody, Laughs Last. You will love it. Go and get it. And I'm looking on Amazon, by the way, as we speak, and he's got other stuff out, too. The Modern Depression Guidebook by Dylan Brody. I'm gonna get that. I promise you I'm going to go and get that. I got to see what that's about. Go check out his website also, dylanbrody.com. Anytime you get a chance to see him, go see him. Follow him on Twitter, at Dylan Brody. Support Dylan Brody. Dylan Brody's awesome. Dylan Brody supports this show. You support Dylan Brody. Dylan Brody's a good man. All right. Thank you, Dylan Brody. I appreciate it. I appreciate the support. I appreciate you supporting the show. And I really hope that everybody out there goes and picks up a copy of Laughs Last. You're going to love it. Our other sponsor today is my friend Mickey Barr, who I grew up with. Isn't it cool when your friends support you? I gotta say, I'm really touched and I'm really happy and it means so much. And I've been, you know, going through my own stuff. I lost a friend, as those of you who listen regularly know. It's been very tough on me. I'm still trying to deal with that and all that comes along with that. And it's not easy. And since I started this show, I'm looking back now that we're closing out the third season. Since the first season of the show, when I started the show, I had a job and I just moved to LA pretty much. I was less than a year into living here. And since then, I lost the job. I've had a struggle in a new city without money. And I don't know how I would have fared without you guys. And that my friends support the show, there's nothing better than that. My buddy Mickey Barr, who I grew up with, has a business now, which is a very good business, a very wonderful business that he does, where he transports cars, any kind of vehicle, in fact, not only around the country. Where, you ask? Don't tune out, because you might be thinking, oh, I'm not in America. I don't need to hear this part of the show. It doesn't pertain to me. It does. He ships cars all over the world. So I have listeners in Japan. I have listeners in the UK, in Canada. And you're thinking, could he ship a car here? You're damn right he could ship a car there. You'd say you get a car on eBay. You're like, I want to ship the car. Who could I ship it with? Number One Auto Transport is the company's name. So you spell out the word number, N-U-M-B-E-R, and then the digit one, Auto Transport. And it's number1autotransport.com. Their number is 855-422-4141. And if you mention the fact that you heard it on the show, he'll give you $25 off whatever car you ship. Let's say you got a motorcycle. He'll ship that shit too. He'll ship anything. He'll ship a crappy car. He'll ship an expensive car. Let's say you're sending your kid away to college and you're like, how am I going to get that? He will ship that car. Man, I should really be doing commercials. I don't know how I don't book these commercials. I could totally be the spokesperson for number1autotransport.com. Ship that car. He'll ship that car anywhere. There is no place too far to ship that car. He could ship that car. Let's say it's only two blocks away and you're like, you know what? I could drive or put it in neutral. I don't need to ship that car. I say support my buddy Mickey Barr and ship that car. Let's say you got somebody annoying in your household. You want to get rid of him. Throw him in the car and ship that car. Ship that car anywhere with number1autotransport.com. Let's say it's not even about shipping a car. Shut up and ship that car. But I'm not even, it's not, ship the car. Ship the car. I don't even have a, ship that car. Number1autotransport.com. Ship that car. Won't you please ship that car? Number1autotransport.com. And my buddy Dylan Brody, get that book. Get that book. Laughs last. Dylan Brody. All right, we ready to start this show? I am. Greg Fitzsimmons, somebody who I've really wanted to get on the show for a very long time, and I'm so happy and honored that I did get him. And here it is, my interview with Greg Fitzsimmons, right after the intro song. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel.
Modern Day Philosophers.
How you doing, Greg?
How am I doing? Well, it's a show about philosophy, so I feel like I should give you a deep answer. But the truth is, my caffeine intake was it's perfect right now. I feel like I'm ramped up the right amount. I'm not crashing. I had lunch at a reasonable time. So for me, a lot of it's chemical. I'm a very delicate constitution. For depression, and so I have to really nail exercise, diet, stress, sat down for 10-15 minutes, close my eyes. If I do all those things...
Do you meditate?
I don't consciously, or I should say unconsciously, meditate. But yeah, I close my eyes, I clear my head a little bit, and I do certain things that are meditative. I do Sudoku every day.
What is Sudoku?
It's a grid of numbers, and you have to fill in It's basically 81 numbers, and some are missing, and there's a pattern you have to fill in.
What's the appeal of Sudoku?
It's just like, I think there's a joy of how clean math is. You know, everything adds up. Everything's exact. I used to really enjoy doing math in school. I liked that there was an answer.
We don't have that in common. I hated math.
Right.
Yeah. I found it so boring because I felt like all the answers have already been found. So,
interesting.
So I was like, well, what history I like because like it's always happening. There's new stuff. I always thought math teachers must be so annoyed because they're not going to discover anything their whole career.
Well, do you think in comedy the answers have all been found?
No, I don't. You know Lucian Hold from the comic strip?
Of course. God rest his soul.
Yeah. He used to say there are only three jokes, and I forgot what he said they were. But
yeah, I've heard that same thing.
I don't think it's true. I think, maybe there are only three ways that a joke can get a laugh. Like maybe there's, you know, misdirection or just shock, surprise.
Irony, reinforcing stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jewish woman's at the beach, and her son is about three and he's splashing around in the wake and all of a sudden a wave grabs him, sucks him out to sea, he's gone. The mother goes running into the, Moishi, Moishi, where's my Moishi? She's searching, she's diving under the water, she comes up, finally she looks at this guy and she says, God, bring me back my Moishi, I'll do anything. And then suddenly the clouds open, there's a clap of thunder and sitting on a dry blue blanket on the sand is Moishi smiling. Happy. She looks at Moishi. She looks at the sky. She says, he had a hat.
You know, I've heard this joke, but it's just you doing it. And the fact that you committed to the whole joke
right. For
the example is so beautiful to me.
Because it's mathematical.
Yeah. It's, you know, just solve the equation for
right. The
laugh.
Right.
I always feel like there's some way to break through in comedy. That's what I'm always waiting for. I feel like there's something I can discover and I'm going to have that moment where I break through all the rest, you know? It's probably just delusions of grandeur, but I think there's going to be a moment where I figure out that extra way to get that laugh, you know?
Right. Well, I guess if you look at art, you know, there's the sort of Da Vinci Code idea that there are certain aesthetic truths, you know, that there's angles that somehow trigger joy in us or emotion in us. And then you had the Impressionists come along and blew it all out of the water. You know, they just said, no, we're going a whole other direction here.
Right.
You know, there's not going to be sharp lines. There's not going to be definition. There's going to be, you know, so I guess with comedy, it's context. I mean, what people reacted to, you know, the first and last joke of your life is farting. You know, it's the first thing a baby laughs at, and I'll be on my deathbed still finding a good fart joke funny. And I think it's just, it's surprise. It's, you didn't expect that. And so I think that what happens during your life then in terms of what's good for comedy, and then I think what happens through society, what we value as funny, changes. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if the comedy changes as much as the, like, I don't think a joke that's being told at the UCB Theater tonight would have appealed to a crowd in the Catskills in the 1950s. You know, you're talking post-war Jews
right. That
are trying to escape the gray hellishness of their urban existence.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be part of a collective, and they want to feel their identity reinforced in a non-shameful way. So comics come up and they do Jewish jokes.
Yeah, but I think if somebody just did something slapstick back then, that would have worked too. Like,
well, it did work back
then. Yeah, Michael Richards type of thing. So
right.
So it doesn't have to speak to them so much as it could just be stupid, you know? And someone at the UCB right. Could definitely do something like
right. That.
Right. You're talking about like the dry sort of off a notepad. I'm trying to picture exactly when you
well,
say
Well, I think now it's a
UCB.
More, it's a, nowadays I think, and again, we're speaking to the segment of comedy that you and I are probably surrounded by more in LA than you are. Like, you know, I'll be in Minneapolis next week where they could give mm-hmm. a fuck what's cool.
Right.
They want to laugh, you know. But I think what you see in these alternative rooms is this very personal narrative, a soft sell. They don't want to feel like you're giving them math.
Right.
They, in the Midwest, they want math. They want three beats, the misdirection about 84% through the joke,
mm-hmm.
a tag, a transition. Whereas I think, you know, at the UCB, they're just looking for, they want something organic and unforced.
It's sort of like strip the show business off of the comedy completely.
Right.
Right.
It'll always be back. I think at the end of the day, the people that are trying are gonna have their day again. You know, I think it's a fashion. It's like what grunge, you know, no one's playing grunge anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, it's now back to, you know, I think a clearer songwriting
right.
I think it's the same thing with anything. I think there's reactions to what came before, and I think there's going to be a reaction to this. I don't want to, you know, sound negative about alternative comedy, but this, like you said, the taking the trying part out. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's never going to win against people that are trying.
Right.
You know, whether or not you show, like, you look at somebody like Bill Burr, and it's like, yeah, he's not polishing jokes before he puts them out. It's raw, but he's thinking about it a lot. He's beating it out, and he's going for it. He's trying to kill.
Right.
He's not trying to connect and be liked. Yeah. Which is what most alternative comedy is. I want to be respected as a comic by my peers.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's a weakness, but I don't care that a crowd likes me at any given point. It's like one of the last things on my list of criteria when I come off stage is, did they like me?
Right.
I want to know, did I you know, accomplish some material I wanted to go into, mm-hmm. and, you know, was I a professional? Did I, you know, I want to kill, but I want to kill because it's a collective response that they're giving me. I don't care, mm-hmm. as individuals if they, you know, want to hang out with me after the show. I prefer they don't.
How could that be a weakness? I don't see.
Well, it is in what, I mean, I go out to some of the cool rooms in LA and I feel like a dinosaur because I'm up there doing punchlines and I'm engaging them in a more of a conflict than a pep. I'm not a cheerleader for them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm challenging them, so that's not what they like. Which involves me resenting them, which is my own insecurities because they are younger. They've got more of a life ahead of them than I do,
mm-hmm.
and so I have to be honest about that, which I am, and that turns them off,
mm-hmm.
because we're all supposed to be in on it together, and it's like, no, we're kind of not. You know, your parents are giving you a trust fund so you can live in an apartment in LA and work in a cubicle for Viacom and go out and judge other comics and blog about it. That's just not, I can't relate to that.
Right. I
but
feel
the
same way. But
you've got the power in a way because people read these blogs. Some fucking guy, you know, I try not to read reviews, but I did a 1-hour special on Comedy Central this fall. And one of the reviews I saw was, you know, some probably cool online site that reviews stuff. And this guy just was so dismissive of me because he found a couple of my jokes to be hacky. It's like, you haven't earned the right to call me hacky. I have been doing this for 23 years. I am respected by I'm not going to list my accolades, but
right.
Who the fuck are you to call? Do you know what hacky means to me in my profession and what what a slander that is? And you throw it around from your fucking, you know, who, you know, and so I wanted to email this guy, but I just said, you know, let it go because that's, if that's what people extract from what I'm doing because I try, sometimes mm-hmm. if you try, you're seen as hacky, you know?
Sometimes I try to pretend these people don't really exist, but they're just sort of challenges along the way. You know, they're not actual people with real brains and feelings and emotions. These are just little things that the universe is testing me with.
Right.
You know,
because they don't really represent the average person. You know, the average person isn't breaking down your comedy. They just want to go in and have a response to it.
And these people don't kind of exist. Like, you don't see them and then you never hear from them again. This guy's not going to have follow up articles about how you're hacky. That's it. He did his one thing and now he no longer exists in your life.
Right.
Forever, ever again. You know?
Yeah. I went to anger management classes about that because I was having road rage, and the therapist said, you know, when you get into a situation where you're squared off with another driver and mm-hmm. they've done something that you feel like you need to correct, that you need to bring justice to the situation, you've got a choice. You can either, you know, create a future with this person mm-hmm. by punching them or running into their car, or you can wave, turn the other way, and never see that person again. Which choice do you want?
Right, yeah. Same way I approach fighting with my girlfriend. Like, I'm like, I know I'm not going to care about this at all tomorrow. So I try to, like, keep that in mind.
Mm.
I'm like, I'm not even going to remember this by dinner tonight. I'm just going to pretend this never happened.
Depends on if it fits into a bigger conflict, though.
Right, yeah. If it's something that needs, you know, corrected in our relationship, you mean.
Yeah, like if she cries after sex every time, then you got to kick her to the curb.
Right.
Because that's not your fault.
Yeah.
That's her shit.
Unless she's being held hostage.
Well, unless that's what she wants.
Right,
some
right.
Some girls are into the hostage thing.
Yeah. I've never had a girl cry after. Have you had a girl cry after sex?
I really liked this girl a lot right out of college. And she was the valedictorian at a very, I won't say what school, but like a top-notch college in Boston. And she was the valedictorian. She was beautiful and sweet, and she'd cry after sex every time. And it turns out it was because her sister had been sexually assaulted. Not even her, but she was very close to her sister, and so it brought stuff up for her. So I, you know, was very...
I don't
understanding and patient with it, and then she started cheating on me with this other guy that I knew, and I was like, all right, there's an elegant dismount for me.
I don't even buy it. I don't believe it was the sister.
You think it was her?
It was her.
You think it was Silence of the Lambs, or would the lambs were really her?
Yeah, I think she was saying, oh, my sister, but it was right. Nobody cries on behalf of someone else's tragedy. Have you ever cried on behalf of someone else's?
I literally have never thought that about her before, and now it makes perfect sense. Thanks for making me feel shitty about making a rape victim cry a lot.
I'm sorry. Should we leave it at that and the interview?
Can I?
Move into the philosophy from that point? Mm. I think that's a good way to jump in.
Yeah, rape to philosophy.
All right, here's your guy, David Hume. Alex picked David Hume for you because he said Greg published a book about letters. His school wrote about him. And there are some letters. I'm in the middle of that book right now. There's some letters that you wrote, too.
Right.
And he picked the philosopher, David Hume, who had a book of letters published. So you and Hume have both got letters
we
published in a book.
We are epistolary authors.
I don't know that word, epistolary. What does it mean?
Letters. People who write letters.
Wow. How did you know that?
From Catholic school, when you talk about, like, you know, this letter from Luke to the Corinthians, those were epistolary.
You know, it was interesting in your book how you were talking about how much you loved, like, I never would have took you for somebody who loved religion.
Yeah. I would say I connected to and believed in the teachings of, you know, the church.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't about the machinations of the church. I never felt much about priests and nuns and all that, but I felt very connected to God, Jesus, and the lessons from the Bible, and I still do. But I would say religion. I always try to distance myself from the word religion, which mm-hmm. I see as a pretty negative thing.
What do you use instead?
Therapy. You know, it sounds really corny, but I feel like my spirituality is about trying to not do things that come to me as reactions to stress or bad feelings. I feel like those are my sins because that's the weak way out of things. And, I've got a very happy marriage and a great relationship with my kids, and I do what I want for a living. And I sort of feel like that's emblematic of living a life that's moral, because I wouldn't have those things if I was riddled with guilt. And guilt, I think, comes from your own distance from your beliefs and how you're behaving.
Mm.
And so I think I was very informed by being raised Catholic. But I think that there were some adjustments made to that playbook. So I would say my religion is, I think that you have to come up with your own moral universe,
mm-hmm.
but then you have to live by it. It's not about having this intellectual understanding of what's right and wrong. It's about, I think, looking at your own limitations and priorities and saying, this is what's important to me, and then having the discipline and the self-will to behave that way. And then forgive yourself if you don't.
I guess the argument against that is that it would be a springboard for moral relativism, right?
I think morality is relativistic. I think that, you know, religion tries to tell you that there are black and white rules that are right for everybody. And I think that's like what's wrong with the schools. We try to teach every kid like they've got the same brain. And I think that morality is the same way. I think that we all have challenges and we have things that we're never going to beat. You know, religions will tell you that anger is a sin, and they'll tell you that lust is a sin. I don't believe they are. I think that lust is a very natural, healthy thing that actually helps you express and feel love. And a sin is when you degrade another person with lust, or you violate a trust because of lust. I think objective morality is what's wrong with religion. I think that, you know, people go, well, if everybody just comes up with their own moral code, then what about people that think it's okay to kill? Well, they're killers. Those are people that are mentally unbalanced, and religion's not going to stop them from killing anybody. Mm-hmm. And the same thing for rape, and the same thing for kicking a dog. You fucking know what's wrong and right, and you try your best to live by it. And if everybody just lives within that, I think that the, you know, the common denominator of good and bad in the world will go higher, because I think a lot of anger and, you know, you look at the amount of rape that happens in the Muslim world, where, you know, where women are forced to hide their bodies, and which is in theory supposed to, you know, keep the heart pure and get rid of lust. You've got a higher incident of rape.
It causes a lot of sexual repression.
Right.
Yeah. There's got to be some things that are universally wrong.
But I think that's societal. I think that every society has to come up with stuff that I think jails are misused. Jail is, you know, when they call them correction facilities, nobody's corrected. I think you should just take people off the street that are going to repeat a crime that you don't want in your society and put them away forever. You know, you take murderers, you take rapists, and you put them away forever. People use drugs. Well, you can't arrest them for using drugs. They're just using drugs. If they kill or rape while on drugs, then that's what they get arrested for. And I think that I don't know who's got the right to say, you know, what's right and wrong, except for a democracy where you come up with those rules. You know, you look at societies that are run by religion, and they're the most fucked up places in the world.
If you leave it up to society, what if it's a corrupt and immoral society?
Well, I would say you have to overthrow that regime. I think that as like a function of society, of a moral society, you have a moral imperative to overthrow. It's written into our Constitution. We have a right to overthrow the government if it's no longer allowing us the pursuit of happiness and liberty and justice, then it's written right in there. It's in the small print. We're allowed to overthrow the government. Every government should be overthrown by the people that choose to do so.
I feel like you should overthrow a government every few years, like an election, just to make sure. Because once it starts going for too long, it's inevitably going to become corrupt.
Right. And, you know, you look at the ones that are totalitarian. You look at North Korea or Cuba. I mean, these are starving nations. There's no quality of living because it's not vibrant. It doesn't change. It's locked into a bunch of rules and goals and standards that were written thousands of years ago, if they were written at all. Mm-hmm. And they need to be overthrown. I want to get Dennis Rodman to get, if we've already gotten 5 black guys into North Korea, 20 more, we can overthrow that place. I mean, Koreans are fucking tiny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or just if you just influence them with how cool they are as basketball players, they might not even have to do anything.
Right. All of a sudden you'll see Koreans with tattoos and tongue rings, and they'll be banging bitches.
That's it. It's over.
Kim Jong-un can't handle that.
He doesn't know what he's getting into. Once Dennis Rodman influences the youth, you know, it's over.
Yeah. There'll be music videos soon.
Yeah, yeah. Bring Dwayne Wade and a few more people.
A slam dunk contest, and they'll all be so intimidated, we'll have a new ruler.
Yeah, it's done.
Yeah.
That's a great strategy. Maybe this has been the secret strategy of the U.S. all along.
Right.
get Dennis Rodman in there. And
yeah, it's the.
All right, so let's go back to our guy.
He's our Trojan horse.
Let's go back to Hume here. Hume argues that all of our ideas are based on experience. For example, we know the color red because we've seen it, but someone born blind doesn't. Therefore, our ideas are subjective, and we must be somewhat skeptical of our knowledge of the whole world. For example, we see the moon rise every night. We cannot say for absolutely sure that we always do so, even though we want to, based on the pattern we have repeatedly seen.
Yeah, it's like, I think he talked about language also, that it is, it falls very short of what your thoughts are. You can only communicate in these sort of like wholesale sounds that indicate, you know, really, really rounded off concepts. But I guess that's what art is the people that can get past language and communicate something that's more ethereal or more like archetypal, like that we can share through the detail of, you know, language or painting or architecture.
Do you think that increasing your vocabulary increases your perception of the world?
Definitely. Definitely. I think, you know, you look at languages like, you know, they say, what is the Chinese have like, what is the language they say? They have like 8 words. No, the Native Americans had like 8 different words for, you know, sunrise. And, you know, and then you look at even the way the British speak, there's a beauty to being able to say something more exactly than we do. I'm an idiot. I was an English major, and I just feel like living in LA, it's even worse. I think the topics even get more narrow, never mind the language.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I think doing Sudoku, learning a second language, I think all those things allow your brain to wake up in different ways, and maybe you have more specific ways to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even explain it. I feel like an idiot because I'm talking about how beautiful language is and I'm not expressing myself well. But to answer your question, yes. That's what I should have said about 12 minutes ago before I sounded like a fucking idiot.
I didn't think you did. I thought
Christ. Hume would be so disappointed in me right now.
Well, luckily he's dead.
He's retired. He's vanquished. He's no longer.
He ceases to be. Did
ceases
he use that
to
one?
Be.
I think Carlin had a whole thing on euphemisms for the word dead, didn't he? I think that was one of his.
Oh, bit, right.
Where he didn't die, he passed away.
Yeah. Or he lost his battle to cancer. That's always one I love. It's like, because it really makes it sound like it's you against cancer.
Right.
Someone's winning. And not only are you dead, you died a loser. That seems like a cruel way to describe it.
I've been doing a bit about how people say they're battling obesity. You know, like I'm battling obesity. Like a fat guy's really going to go to a, like I have, that implies certain energy that I don't have.
Right.
Me versus obesity.
Yeah. If you were really battling something, you'd probably drop a few pounds.
I think I just joined obesity. Like I saw obesity as a pretty strong force and I was like, all right, I'll come along on your side. I don't think there's much of a battle here.
Well, and then you lose the weight, you look in the mirror and you realize you got a fucked up face. And then you have to say, well, I won the battle, but I lost the war. Can use that in your
book. I like that. All right. David Hume passed away on August 25th, 1776. He was born, he lived from 1711
in France
to 1776. No, did he? Because here he says he was a Scottish philosopher, historian, economist, essayist, especially known for his philosophical empiricism and skepticism. Skepticism just means skeptical.
Well, probably means he challenged the status quo, like the Church of England.
Mm-hmm. He was one of the most important figures in the history of Western philosophy and the Scottish Enlightenment. Hume is often grouped with John Locke, George Berkeley, who we've discussed on this show, and a handful of others as a British empiricist. Beginning with his A Treatise of Human Nature, which he wrote in 1739, Hume strove to create a total naturalistic science of man that examined the physiological basis of human nature. He concluded that desire rather than reason governed human behavior, saying reason is and ought to only be the slave of passions. What does that mean? Reason is and only...
Well, I think he's kind of saying what I said, which is like, you know, how you feel is your truth. That reason would be, you know, your rules for yourself, your ethical system. Mm-hmm. But that ethical system is external to how your passions are, what you feel, mm-hmm. whether it's a passion for good or evil, that's what's inside of you.
Right.
Yeah.
And how do you govern that? And how do you know when it's evil?
Well, evil is an external word. You know, like when I hear the, you know, George Bush used to talk about evil.
I think he ruined the word evil for everybody.
He really did. I just thought, God damn, who are you to call something evil? I'm not saying he's evil, but like, who is anybody to say that's evil? Or like, you know, that 58% of Americans believe in the devil? So this idea of evil, good and evil, you know, which is, you know, Old Testament, you're born into sin. There's natural sin. You just come out. And because you're human, you're just already got to apologize.
That's not a Jewish idea. That's a Catholic or Christian idea. That we don't have.
Right.
So
You guys have guilt. We have shame.
Right. I like guilt better than shame. Because guilt...
Oh, definitely.
You make your own guilt.
Yes. Shame is you are bad. Guilt is you did a bad thing. Mm-hmm. You can correct that and you can avoid that.
That's interesting.
I can't get around being a piece of shit. I feel like I'd be a happy person if I really have a lot of guilt. And yeah, I think I was born with shame. I mean, I look at my body naked and I feel ashamed of it. I mean, I think they say that's a big sign that you carry real shame because, you know, your body shouldn't be ashamed of who you are.
If I had your body, Greg, I wouldn't have any shame. I'm telling you, this body is lousy. I feel like we're... I'm ashamed of your body. Yeah.
No, I was jealous of guys like you. Honestly, when I was young, I was so skinny and pale. I saw guys like you that had some girth, and I just thought, God, why can't I be like that? I want to spill out of the side of my fucking sneakers. You know, I want to wheeze when I walk up a hill. I'm not kidding. I was so ashamed of being skinny.
What?
I was jealous of big people.
I was jealous of you. I was jealous of the scrawny kid. I was like, oh, really? Man, yeah, people probably assume the best of the little guy.
Right.
People assume the worst of the big guy. Like,
really?
Yeah.
I think I'm this gentle.
Yeah,
and also, you can take care of yourself. I felt vulnerable being skinny.
I felt like people immediately when they see a big guy, they think that guy's a bully. Or that guy is manipulative or whatever it is.
Yeah.
He's a big guy. He's going to push around his weight. I've heard people even said that to me in a sketch when they were improvising with me once. The guy goes, hey, what are you going to push? It was me and a black guy. He goes, what are you going to push your weight around on me, big guy?
Yeah.
And I was thinking, yeah, I think that's what people think when they see a big guy is he's just going to push his, like, I don't even know what that means. Just push his weight onto you.
And what did you say? And what are you going to do? Call three other black guys to jump me?
I don't remember.
Well, getting back to the point.
Said. Mm-hmm.
I do think that being raised Catholic, I was handed a lot of shame, you know, because I really dug what I was told. I believed what I was told, that there was heaven and that there was hell and that the things I was feeling were bad.
Have you found any ways through all your digging around inside to alleviate guilt? Anything effective?
Nope. No.
There's nothing out there.
No, you know, I work on it all the time, but it's just there. It's always there.
Hmm.
I think that I've made improvements in myself. I just think that guilt is the thing that is, it just is like a baseline I can't get up from. I mean, I can make better cognitive decisions in my life. Mm-hmm. Like we're talking about anger management. I'm doing things like that better. But not... You know, being able to view myself in a better way is really a challenge. You know, it's there's no easy fix for that. I get up, I exercise. You know, I'm in a really good, the last year, I exercise. I spend more quality time with my family. I was talking about eating right. I do everything I can to put myself in the best place I can. But the guilt is the thing that just drags me down every day.
Damn.
And I'm a good guy. I don't drink. I've never cheated on my wife. I am good to people. You know, I don't know what else I could do on paper to be a better person, but I don't feel any better. about it.
That sucks.
Yeah.
That sucks to hear. It's so uninspirational.
I know.
I was waiting for some gem there to... Nothing, huh? So I wonder, does
it... The power of now helps a lot.
Yeah, I've been working on that, just trying to enjoy the moment.
Right.
Yeah.
And just think to yourself, all right, I'm having this thought. You know, when I start to really get stressed out and feeling down on myself, I think, okay, you're having a thought about disliking yourself right now. You're having a thought about not having enough money for your kids. And just by shining a light on the fact that it's a thought mm-hmm. and not a reality, it just sort of dissipates it.
Yeah, that's harnessing the imaginative faculties in your mind. I've been trying to work on that too, just because I feel like the imagination is the best and worst tool I have.
Right.
And probably with you too, because we're comedians, we're very imaginative people. See, I figured that's probably where all my anxiety is coming from,
mm-hmm.
is that I have such a good imagination that I can manifest what isn't into what is in my mind.
Right.
Like I have all these hospital bills that I'm still paying off from years ago. All these times I've checked myself into the hospital thinking I was dying of various diseases, but I didn't think it. I was sure of it. But I think it's just having such a strong imagination that I can actually manifest these symptoms of different diseases to the point that I believe it. I'm tricked. I trick myself. So I think based on that, that's where I'm trying to use that to control anxiety. Because if I counter my imagination, like I had one of these the other day where I thought I was getting very, very sick from something, and I decided to counter it by thinking I'm super healthy and try and push my imagination to counterattack
mm-hmm.
the other one. And it worked. It neutralized and I felt fine and I went on with the day.
Yeah, what Hume would say that disease is a spectrum. I think in the case of a lot of sickness, we put we see I have an autoimmune deficiency.
Right.
And that becomes a label for it. And we see the symptoms of it. And we say, I have those. And this is what needs to be done about it. As opposed to Hume would probably just say that, your body is fighting against disease or mm-hmm. Whatever it is that's wrong with you may not necessarily be treatable by exactly what the science community would say right now is the antidote for that thing. Because they're all... Mm-hmm. They're all, just concepts, man-created concepts. They're not reality, which is, you can't argue with real disease, but that I think a lot of the things that afflict us are not nameable, and they are fixable somewhat mentally. I think that relaxing and resourcing yourself and sleeping more gets rid of a lot. And I think that for people who worry so much about cholesterol and red meat and all this stuff, your chances of having a heart attack are much higher if you're stressed out than if you eat the wrong foods.
Yeah. So just calmly eat that steak and
that's right.
You'll
enjoy
be
it.
All right.
Look at the French.
Yeah. All right. Let me go back to our guy here. He was a prominent figure in the skeptical philosophical tradition and a strong empiricist. He argued against the existence of innate ideas, which we talked about, concluding instead that humans have knowledge only of things that they directly experience, which is why I guess every comic will say the more experiences you have, the more material you can have.
Or the more you can mine your experiences in a deeper, more truthful way.
Mm-hmm. He developed the position that mental behavior is governed by custom. Our use of induction, for example, is justified only by our idea of the constant conjunction of causes and effects. Without direct impressions of a metaphysical self, he concluded that humans have no actual concept of the self, only a bundle of sensations associated with the self.
So in other words, we talk about the difference between, religion and I would say morality, and I guess what he's saying is that like most people live by the cause effect that they see around them.
Mm-hmm.
And the constructs of, a morality that you get from a religion or from the state versus a metaphysical understanding of what you really believe is right and wrong.
Hume advocated a compatibilist theory of free will that proved extremely influential on subsequent moral philosophy. He was also a sentimentalist who held that ethics are based on feelings rather than abstract moral principles. Hume also examined the normative is ought problem.
That like what reality is versus what reality ought to be?
I would guess that's what he means, but I don't know for certain.
Hmm.
I think so, right?
I guess.
It ought to be.
It ought to be, right?
Unless it isn't. He held notoriously ambiguous views of Christianity, but famously challenged the argument from design in his Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, 1777.
So he did believe, but he questioned.
Mm-hmm.
He was a skeptic.
Notoriously.
Mm.
I don't believe that I know very much in terms of not even just God and religion, but in terms of anything. Because it's always being challenged, right. You know, and it's always changing.
Right. Well, it's like, you know, when you're that, and I am that person who's achieved most of the things that I thought were going to make me happy and then still feeling bad. And that's actually freed me. And if I've had progress in therapy, it's probably that I don't believe that there is X, Y, and Z quantifiable things that are going to make me a happier person, which is freeing. Now I feel much more like, okay, don't define things as good and bad as much, and try to be present and try to be non-judgmental. I mean, you're with kids, you have to learn patience, and you have to learn that your kid's not good or bad. Your kid's just being a kid, and you got to just be the kid's parent. Mm-hmm. And so that's, and you're amazed by the moments that are the best ones, because they're not necessarily at the circus or at Disneyland or, you know, on a carriage ride in Central Park. A lot of times they're just like a moment where your kid's crying and he reaches out for you. And it's like, wow, that doesn't get any better than that. And I just thought he was crying. I thought this was going to suck. And that turned out to be a breakthrough moment. So I guess it's like keeping yourself open to not defining. I'm going to keep bringing it back to Hume, since this seems relevant. But I think that what he's saying is like, don't live by ideas, because they are just weak. They're weak concepts trying to describe an impression. Unless I'm completely misunderstanding Hume, but I guess...
at least that's what we're getting out of it.
That's what we're getting out of it.
So it can't be completely wrong, because it's inspiring some kind of thought in us.
Or we are taking Hume to the next level. We're building on Hume.
It took a while, but we're finally doing it.
Right.
You're welcome, Hume.
Right. Ex-Huming. We'll call this show Ex-Hume.
There you go. You brought it back to language.
Yes.
Like, yeah.
Learning and growing in my garage.
Inspiring. The inspirations... Mr. Fitzsimmons, we have three quotes to round off the show here.
To hate, to love, to think, to feel, to see, all this is nothing but to perceive. Well, it's interesting because he says to feel and to see, which are perception. And then he also says to hate and to love, which are emotions. So it sort of feels like I'm not clear on how you lump all those into perception. All this is nothing but to perceive. I mean, to think is to take the feeling and the seeing and to turn it into something, to turn it into an emotion.
Mm-hmm. Just processing.
Right. All right. So I don't get that one. Next. I'm not going to sit here and say I understand David Hume when I don't.
All right.
There's parts of my understanding, there's parts I don't. Well, mostly because what I like about him is, as a philosopher, he doesn't say this is the right way to live, this is the right way to think.
Mm-hmm.
He just is more of, I think he's trying to describe the way we interact with the world morally and experientially. So He's not a preacher. Not a preacher.
Yeah.
This one says, reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passion and can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them.
Well, okay? That's kind of what we were talking about before.
Right. You get your passions. That's your truth, your passions. What do you feel? What do you believe? What's right? What's wrong? And then reason is the thing that you try to control the passions with.
Sometimes I feel like I lack passion. I'm not passionate enough. And I think that puts me at a detriment as a comedian, because Like, you know, you see guys like Lewis Black who are very passionate, even about little things. And I lack passion so much. And I've tried talking about that a bit on stage, but I want more passion. Do you know where I can pick up some passion for something?
Hey, I have some kids. I think it's hard when you live alone. Well, you're not married. You with your girlfriend?
Yeah, I live with my girlfriend.
I don't know, man. You have no stakes in your life. It's easy.
Raise the stakes.
How are you going to find passion when, you know, you got all your basic human needs are met. You got food, shelter, clothing, sex, car.
Yeah.
You know, where's the passion coming from?
You're right.
Go travel and have some kids.
Where's Lewis getting his passion from?
It's not real.
No?
It's an act. No, I know Lewis. He's a very, very rational, calm guy.
Yeah, I mean, I know him too, but on stage, where's he generating that passion?
Where does Marlon Brando get his passion? I mean, he's an actor. He's a comedian. You know, he's not up there. I mean, Bill Burr, he's not really that. Well, Bill is pretty wound up, but like you're seeing an extreme version of it.
But wouldn't it be disingenuous for me to get up there and be passionate about shit that I'm not passionate
about? Yeah, and look, those guys are at the high end of it. Like their passion is based in some real thoughts and feelings.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's a crutch for a lot of comedians just go with angry, which isn't really passion. It's just it's a really easy way to always connect to crowds because when you're yelling and screaming, they kind of go, "Wait, yeah."
Yeah.
But I think that you know, you can be passionate about not being passionate.
I'm so afraid I'm going to get up there. I'm going to be so passionate about something. Someone's going to come up to me afterwards and they're going to just give me a simple opposing view. And I'm like, oh, fuck.
Right.
Well, there goes that chunk of material.
Right. That's why I always try to preface everything I say with, I know nothing. I pretend I have a lot of facts at my disposal, which are usually wrong, but I sell them as facts and people buy them and I can usually walk away. Once in a while I get held up on it and I just go, hey, I told you. I told you I don't know this shit. If you forgot that halfway through, that's your fault.
There was a disclaimer.
Right. So there is that. Finally, that the sun will not rise tomorrow is no less intelligible a proposition and implies no more contradiction than the affirmation that it will rise. Well, yeah.
You don't know.
Go to Vegas. You know, if you go to Vegas and you see people gambling. Like, here's how I lost all my money the first time I went to Vegas. My friend explained to me this double down philosophy, which is you go to the roulette wheel and you can bet, what is there, like 32 numbers on a roulette wheel, and half are red and half are black. So you go to the table and two are green. The house wins on green and the rest are red and black. And so my friend said, you put down $5 on red. First, you watch the wheel go a bunch of times. And you wait for it to go black like three times in a row, four times in a row. You throw $5 down on red. And then if you lose that $5, you put $10 on red because then the odds are even more that it's going to be red. Then you get your original bet back. Then you double that if you lose it. And you keep doubling on it. And then eventually it's going to hit red. Okay, so I'm thinking about driving out to Vegas. I'm crunching the numbers. I'm going through scenarios. We get there, I got like $250 in my pocket. I watch, black comes up three times. Boom, throw it down on red, comes up black. 10 on red, comes up black. 20 on red, comes up black. Four, until I've tapped out and I've got it all on the line and it hits green.
Ah, man.
They take all my chips and the dealer just looks at me and goes, yeah, that never works.
That is how I lost all my money in Scotland at the casino. I was telling you before the show.
Right.
That same idea, going for red, and the same punchline that it came up green at the end,
right,
lost me my entire spending for an entire tour
in
the UK.
The lesson is...
go to the poker table.
The lesson is the odds are no better on betting on that red in that given instance than they were before. The frequency of an event happening, unless you can explain it, has no correlation to how it will happen in the future. So for all the people, for all the scientists that will tell you that the sun is going to rise every single morning because of X, Y, and Z, okay, they haven't been in space. They don't actually know, you know, whatever Einstein failed to explain with field theory. it's all theories. You know, they just discovered a planet that's 20 million light years away yesterday that's made of all gas. And you say, well, wait a minute. In our lifetime, one light year would take a year. How does 20 million, how do you get a reflection back giving you information? Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's great, and I'm sure it can be explained, but the thinness of truth that exists in their theory on this is as thin as why is the sun going to come? Why is it going to come up red? Well, because it just makes sense.
It's not accounting for randomness in the universe at all.
Right.
Yeah.
So we put so much emphasis on, you know, he's empirical. And, you know, we put so much emphasis on what we think we're perceiving and in our very simple ability to name it and to come up with theories about it. That's all bullshit. That's all to calm us down from the fact that it's all chaos and we'll never really understand what life is. And that's where he probably never let go of his belief because even Einstein said at the end of all this, the shit I can't explain, that's God.
Right, and people debate what he meant by that.
But. Yeah, a lot of people say that he really did not believe in God whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But I always felt like there was a little hint of God with Einstein.
Yeah. So that when it comes to belief in God with Einstein, you have to first believe that he believes to believe. There's layers of belief. Do you right. believe in Einstein? Do you believe Einstein believed? Do you right. believe in what
right,
he believed?
Right. Right.
Well, this was fun, Greg. Thanks for doing the show.
Fantastic. Thanks for having me on, and I wish you continued success. I've always liked you. I think you're a good guy. I think you do have passion. You know, you come up with things to do in broadcasting, and you stick with them. You do them at a very high quality, and that's there's some passion underneath that.
Well, thank you, Greg.
God bless America.
Thank you for that. Yeah, God bless America. That's a good way to end. And then next time we'll pick up with... Is there an America, and can God bless it?
Right.
Thanks again. All right, everybody, that's the season 3 finale. Thank you again to Greg Fitzsimmons. Thank you guys for tuning in. Thanks for being with me. Thanks for being part of the Braveheart Army here. The Modern Day Philosopher's Braveheart Experience. Please make a donation if you can. Go to moderndayphilosophers.net. If you make a donation of $20 or more, I'll send you out some Tweaked Audio earbuds. Compliments of tweakedaudio.com. And by the way, let's say you're thinking, you know what, I'd rather just go and pick out which earbuds I'd like. I'm in the market. You go to tweakedaudio.com. You can use the promo code MDP and get 1/3 off on your order and free shipping. So that ain't bad. That ain't bad. May as well do it. Thecomical@yahoo.com is where you can reach me. Email in, say hello. iTunes, leave 5 stars and a nice comment if you want to help the show's growth. You want to help build it up, which I would very much appreciate if you could do that in any country that you're in. Jump on iTunes, leave a nice comment, put 5 stars, and go on with your day. It helps. And again, thank you to my sponsors, Mr. Dylan Brody and Mickey Barr, and thanks to everybody who sponsored the show all season long. It really means a lot, and it helps me survive, and it helps me make the show possible. So do that. Support the show if you can. And if you can't, support those who support the show. So go pick up a copy now of Laughs Last on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com. Get a Dylan Brody book to read. You can't go wrong. And also, if you need to ship a car, number1autotransport.com. Ship that car! Ship that car! Buy that book, ship that car. All right, everyone, we'll see you next week with the Season 3 wrap-up show with Alex Fasella. Very excited to be talking to my buddy Alex again on the show. This show couldn't be possible without him as well. He is a huge part of the show. He is the puppet master behind the curtain. Alex Fasella, go check his stuff out as well. Find him on Facebook, find him on Twitter, and I'll see you guys next week. Thanks, everybody, and be well. Enjoy yourselves, and I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.